Untold thousands, maybe millions of students will read J.D. Salinger's 1951 novel, The Catcher in the Rye, this year. It will be read and treasured by many, barely read, and mostly forgotten by many others. But one thing's for sure, it'll be assigned. High school teachers have been assigning the story of Holden Caulfield, his anger, angst, expulsion from prep school, and struggles to make sense of his life in New York since John F. Kennedy was in the White House. They know the book. They have supporting materials to pass out. They know how to teach it. But Anne Trubeck, a professor of English at Oberlin College, argues in the current issue of Good magazine that the book ought to be replaced in curriculum. Professor Trubeck joins us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So what's your problem with The Catcher in the Rye?
I don't have a problem with The Catcher in the Rye, but it's often assigned as the end of the year, as it were, contemporary novel that's supposed to resonate with high school students. But as you mentioned, it was published in 1951, and it's not so contemporary anymore. And I think we should start looking at what novels might do a better job of reaching high school students and talking about their experiences.
Let me try to make the case for The Catcher in the Rye for you.
Okay.
Beginning with the fact that this book used to get banned a lot. Mm-hmm. I found that very alluring.
Absolutely. And it still is banned in some school districts. But I think that most American teenagers will find it rather tame and sort of laughable, the things that were once considered so controversial.
You say in this article in Good magazine that, as a matter of fact, The Catcher in the Rye supplanted David Copperfield when it was included in a lot of reading lists.
Well, Salinger begins by having Holden say that he's not going to rehearse all that David Copperfield crap. And he really sort of takes a pot shot at Dickens mm-hmm. by sort of positioning his novel as a more contemporary coming-of-age tale and sort of saying, look, kids have been forced to read this text forever. That's sort of what Holden is saying, and I'm going to cut through all that and be something that's going to speak to you, contemporary readers of this novel. So Salinger actually positions himself as a replacement for Copperfield.
Aside from the fact that Holden Caulfield, you know, never used a cell phone or went to a Starbucks, what, in your judgment, makes his experience no longer pertinent?
Well, I think his experience of adolescent alienation is pertinent. But he's also an upper-class white man who's going to a prep school. And so he is from a very elite background. And many of the people who first wrote about how he was such a universal voice for American teenagers came from that same class and had the power and prestige to write about him. And people who have different backgrounds may not have felt the same at the time and may not feel the same today.
But it's a classic, isn't it? Books that have been published and might seem to be more pertinent that have been published in the last 5 or 6 years can't really be called classics yet, can they?
Well, actually, Catcher in the Rye was considered an instant classic. It was vaunted to the stature of classic only a few years after it was published. Classics are man-made, and no reason why we couldn't do the same with some of the things that have been written the last 10 years.
You suggest some books.
I think Jeffy Eugenides has a book called The Virgin Suicides. Juno Diaz, whose novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, won the Pulitzer this year, has a book of short stories called Drown. My students all were telling me about this book called The Perks of Being a Wallflower. That was one that they all thought was a great novel about their experiences.
Professor, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Anne Trubeck, professor of rhetoric and composition and English at Oberlin College, speaking to us from member station WCPN, the Idea Stream in Cleveland. For more of Professor Trubeck's contemporary coming-of-age lit picks, you can go to our website, npr.org.
Commentator and cookbook author Nancy Bagot is perfectly willing to brave the mosquito hordes as long as she gets to that pot of melted gold at the end of her Labor Day weekend picnic.
My family's gathering for a cookout. I'm all set. My sticks are whittled and a sack of marshmallows, grams, and chocolate bars waits by the door. I wouldn't want to miss this last chance of the season for the sanctioned overindulgence called eating s'mores. I'm already mentally fast-forwarding through the steak grilling and corn roasting and chit-chatting, and I'm on to the main event. Never mind that we cook over a backyard grill instead of a crackling campfire. No matter that lawn chairs and landscaping and gas lamps stand in for a deep, still forest, or that the odor of charcoal supplants the purifying scent of smoldering logs and tall pines. In my mind's eye, my grandchildren merge with the kids I recall from my camp counseling days, eager but callow and in dire need of improved marshmallow roasting technique. If you don't get them hot, they won't melt the chocolate and glue the grams together, I want to warn them. But I respect that it's an art requiring practice, that youngsters need to find their own personal s'more style. Maybe my grandkids will mimic my daughter-in-law, whose technique is sensible and refined, but a touch persnickety. She calculates the proper distance for holding her white puffs from the heat, then slowly, methodically rotates them until golden brown. My son's approach is shocking and utterly incomprehensible to his mother. He pushes the marshmallows and graham crackers aside and simply eats the chocolate bar. This peculiar predilection, which I hope his children never witness, must be inherited from the other side of the family. Other than upgrading to premium chocolate and sometimes to homemade marshmallows, my own s'mores method hasn't changed much in decades. The puffy confections stay by the glowing embers until they sizzle and singe and suddenly ignite. I let the fireballs char on the outside until mostly carbonized, then, poof, I blow out the flames. Yes, this occasionally results in something resembling ashes and lumps of coal, but when I'm on, it yields an amazing amalgam of fragrant, partly molten, partly crispy, chewy, burnt sugar goo that fully melts the chocolate and plays beautifully off the graham cracker crunch. No wonder these goodies are called s'mores. With the plaintive sound of the folk tune Kumbaya suddenly playing in my head, I mourn the fast-approaching end of grilling season and contemplate the cold, s'moresless months ahead. Perhaps I can put my cookbook author skills to work and create some clever indoor s'mores recipes to carry me through. How about a batch of oven-baked cinnamon graham and cranberry-studded s'mores bars for Thanksgiving? Or maybe a chocolate peppermint s'mores pie topped with broiled marshmallows and red and green sprinkles for Christmas? I'm sure my son will pronounce them ghastly, but they will drive my grandchildren absolutely wild.
Commentator Nancy Bagot actually makes her marshmallows from scratch. Imagine that. You can find a recipe on our website, npr.org. And the song of Hiawatha that we spoke of just a few minutes ago inspired our parting words tonight. They come from another poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. The songbirds leave us at summer's close, only the empty nests are left behind, and pipings of the quail among the sheaves. That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon.
Scientists working in the Brazilian rainforest say they found the remnants of several clusters of towns built as long as 7 centuries ago. Anthropologists have long debated whether indigenous people in the tropical Amazon developed an urban culture. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, these latest findings suggest they did.
500 years ago, the Spanish explorer Francisco de Orellana paddled the length of the Amazon River in search of El Dorado, the fabled city of gold. He didn't find it, and no one has found lost cities in the Amazon forests. 20th century anthropologists concluded that urbanism in pre-Columbian South America existed only in the Andes Mountains. Michael Heckenberger didn't believe that. He's an anthropologist, and he's been working in a place in the southern Amazon called Xingu. There, he's found signs of dozens of villages, at least 750 years old.
The real kind of head ringer is the fact that they never occur alone.
Instead, they were built in clusters. Satellite photographs reveal ancient disturbances of the earth where people had built the villages. They were laid out geometrically, with a larger village and a big plaza in the middle of each cluster. Heckenberger from the University of Florida compares them to medieval villages in Europe.
The Xinguano communities, not only were their settlements as large as some of the small to medium-sized medieval towns, but there was four of them tied to major center, and they were tied in very specific orientations. It's like almost like laying out a compass.
These clusters were aligned toward points in the sky for summer and winter solstices, when the sun reaches its northernmost and southernmost extremes. Heckenberger's team has excavated what were wide roads running through the villages, and more roads connecting the clusters to each other. Though very little remains of these towns, there are still deep ditches where Heckenberger believes palisade fences, much like medieval European walls, once stood.
One of the things the Xingu has in spades, I mean, it just blows your mind. Self-organization is just off the scale. This is just written on the landscape.
Heckenberger believes tens of thousands of people would have lived there. These were not cities as the Incas built them. They were more dispersed, yet connected. Heckenberger says the layout is unique and calls it a sort of garden city. Jonathan Haas is an archaeologist at the Field Museum in Chicago who studies Latin American cultures. He says this runs counter to traditional views of early Amazonian living.
I mean, what you have in the Amazon is you don't have the ability to centralize production of resources because the landscape doesn't lend itself to that. The landscape is dispersed in terms of its distribution of resources. And that's why you don't get the full formal centralization that you get in those other large city-states.
Haas says that's one reason why people doubted that Amazonians would bother to build centralized cities. He says the discovery in the Xingu region suggests a sort of middle way for rainforest urbanization.
It shows you how humans will take a different kind of environment and experiment with it, and they come up with different kinds of solutions in different areas.
The discovery is described in this week's issue of the journal Science. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
We do a lot of stories on the show about people learning in classrooms. But for thousands of students every year, learning takes place miles from any school in places like Lodore Canyon in western Colorado. NPR's Larry Abramson spent a few days with students there finishing up a 70-day wilderness course with the National Outdoor Leadership School.
Why would a 20-something give up iPods, alcohol, a soft bed, all the things that young people supposedly hold dear, and sleep on the ground for 2.5 months? Each of the 11 students on this wilderness course has a different reason. Josh Sherman, a music student from Nelson, British Columbia, wants to prepare for an uncertain future.
We're running out of water. We're running out of oil. I'm not a pessimistic guy, but I would say that it just behooves you to know how to pitch a tent and be able to live outside.
Josh is tall, frizzy-haired, one of the more spiritually inclined members of this group. Many are at turning points in their lives, trying to decide what to do. Others want to test themselves in the outdoors before they sign on to a life of work. Rick Biederman, a high school teacher from the Chicago area, says he came because he wants to bring something back to his students at Hinsdale South High School.
Kids really don't get out and do a lot of this stuff. You know, we're sort of trapped in suburbia where video games have become the norm. And not many people even get out to the forest preserves in our area.
Biederman parted with $10,000 of his own money in the hopes of bringing awareness of the outdoors to his suburban school. The 11 students have had plenty of surprises since they got off the bus in Wyoming's Absaroka Mountains in early June. They were hit by 2 weeks of unexpected snow. Now that they're entering Lodore Canyon on the Green River in western Colorado, they face a new danger.
We're going to aim for a 25-minute scout.
Today, Josh Sherman is leader of the day. He tells the flotilla of rafts and kayaks to stop and scout the first section of rapids. The river is higher than usual and will easily flip rafts or smash a kayaker's head against the rocky bottom.
We have a lot of food on board, and if we lost it, it would be a disaster because I love to eat.
Josh will steer an ungainly oar raft loaded with a ton of gear. In a wilderness version of a thesis defense, students must justify their path down the river before their instructors.
We want left to right momentum?
Yeah,
we
left.
Want...
Well, pretty much straight to right.
In the middle of the channel is a warning sign, a red boat that wrecked weeks ago. Instructor Amy Christensen turns this into an object lesson.
The guy who was rowing the dory, we asked him what happened, and he said, you know, I've done this a million times, and I just wasn't paying attention for this rapid. So what trap is that? Complacency. So remember, pay attention, pay attention.
Right back, left forward. All forward.
But even those who pay attention can get wet or worse. One boat suddenly turns turtle. Rick Biederman, the teacher from Chicago, hangs upside down in the water, then emerges from his kayak. He leans against a rock, clearly in great pain.
I just got some what we call instant feedback.
Tell me what that means.
I hit a rock.
On your knee?
On my left knee, yeah. So it's a little wobbly right now.
You're gonna keep kayaking? Or
oh, absolutely. Yeah, you don't need your knees in kayaking, right?
We're making breakfast burritos, and we're cooking bacon for BLTs for lunch.
The next morning, student Mark Wadsworth from New Hampshire is on kitchen duty. The work starts at sunup and ends at 10 p.m. many days with little personal time. Most work is done in teams, which leads either to teamwork or bickering. After nearly 70 days of sharing tents, food, and body odors, students are getting on each other's nerves. Chorus leader Frank Preston warns them about this.
More of the communication I saw this morning was kind of little groups of people talking about other groups of people or why they were mad at so-and-so, and I don't think that's healthy. And I definitely know that it's not safe if we carry that on to the river.
Working well with others isn't just key to safety. Students can take this course for college credit. Teamwork and leadership affect students' grades.
Well, first, Rick, it's been a pleasure having you on the course. We've all enjoyed you. You've been a very valuable member of the group.
As a teacher, Rick Biederman is used to giving out grades, but on the last evening of the course, he gets his Knowles evaluation. Instructor Larry Berger sits down with Biederman after dinner. Rick gets a B+ on his kayaking skills.
Basically, just needs a little more work and more experience.
You know, being an athlete all my life, I thought, hey, I'll pick this up real quick. And I didn't, because I wasn't having as much success as I wanted to. That made me more hesitant to be a leader.
And that, in fact, is the real point of these courses. If you can guide a group of rafters through rapids, if you can keep everyone safe and well-fed in the desert, you can probably lead people through anything, be it the boardroom or, in Biederman's case, the classroom. Here, Biederman has been a star. He's been giving his fellow students mini-courses in astronomy and geology as they move through the canyon.
On your leadership day, you led with good style, and you were a very vocal leader. People were good at following your direction.
Many students have struggled with this role. After he led the group for a day, Josh Sherman confessed,
"What I learned is that I've got to change from my sort of passive hippie dude leadership style to a more full-on confrontational style. And I tried a little bit of that out today, and it felt really good."
Josh Sherman says he thought this course would be a meditative experience, just man and nature. Instead, it has turned out to be intensely social. As difficult as it has been for this group to bond, it will be even more painful to debond. Many are openly tearful at the prospect of leaving one another. For the instructors, this is just another turn of the wheel. Amy Christensen has been down this river about 40 times. She's only 25.
I will finish this course at noon, and by 8:30 on the next day, I need to be at the put-in for the Lower Salmon River to meet up with my boyfriend to do a trip there.
Only one of the 11 students actually plans to become an outdoor guide, but many say they are now rethinking their career choices. One plans to leave the business world and become a teacher. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
Times are tough and budgets are tight for cities all across the country. Some cities are raising taxes, others are cutting spending. And in Duluth, Minnesota, they're selling windows. Well, just one window, actually. This week, the city council passed a resolution to sell a 115-year-old window, a huge piece of stained glass designed by Lewis Comfort Tiffany. And Ken Buehler knows a lot about this window. He runs the art center that houses it in Duluth. Welcome to the show.
Jackie, it's a pleasure to be here.
How much are city officials hoping to get for the Tiffany window?
The window has been appraised several times, and it should bring somewhere between $1.5 to $2 million.
Now, this isn't just a pattern. This depicts a figure quite dear to Minnesotans.
Well, the window is called the Minnehaha window, and it depicts the Native American princess Minnehaha, who, of course, was a character in the Longfellow Hiawatha poem. She's wearing a long and flowing robe, which Tiffany produced by taking thick glass and actually putting waves in it so it looks like it's flowing off of her shoulders. She's standing in front of a multicolored blue falls. The unique feature about her and what makes this window so valuable is the fact that Tiffany never really did figures in his windows. It's more what the figures saw when they looked out, as a window should be. In this case, though, you see the figure and her face, which is hand-painted, and it's absolutely beautiful.
Was she commissioned by the city?
She was commissioned by the St. Louis County Women's Auxiliary in 1892 for inclusion in the 1893 Columbian Exposition in the Minnesota Pavilion.
No doubt this is controversial, selling something that's been an heirloom like this. How big a loss is it, would you say?
Well, you know, it's a sad thing when a community starts to sell the family jewels. And obviously these are desperate times in the city of Duluth, calling for desperate measures. The fear that we have is that the window will be bought and purchased by someone who will put it in a bathroom in Bernai. But what we would like is to have local people of means buy the window from the city and to then donate it to a historical society.
Well, I can see where it would be causing a lot of anxiety.
Yep.
When is it supposed to go on sale?
Well, unfortunately, this is a fast track. It looks like the City Council on the 15th of September will be asked to approve a resolution that would call for boxing and crating the piece and sending it to an auction house in New York City, with the idea that it would probably be out of Duluth by the end of September.
Ken Buehler is the executive director of the Historic Union Depot Corporation in Duluth. Thanks very much for telling us about the window, Mr. Buehler.
Well, thank you, Jackie. It's a privilege, and we're going to work hard to make sure that it stays in Duluth.
And if people would like to look at the Minnehaha window in Duluth, please go to our website, npr.org.
We're going to play something for you now from Dookie Treats. That's the newest CD by George Duke. Close your eyes. See where you think you are.
I'm back on the bus. I don't want to hear no fuss. Because I got all the love. What the bus? Is y'all going to fuss at me for?
Well, whatever your particular personal memory might be, we'll just bet it's not set in 2008. This new album from the veteran keyboard player, composer, arranger, and bandleader honors funk.
I'm bringing them.
George Duke joins us now from NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Scott.
You know, this album is so refreshing. It's alt nothing.
Yeah, the essential thing is I had been assaulted by my fans about why don't you know you do a funk album. And so finally, after years of this, I decided, let me go ahead and do this. But I wanted it to be on a bed of jazz with a lot of jazz and a lot of fresh, spontaneous playing. Because I hear a lot of R&B being done nowadays, and most of it is really old. I mean, it's the original stuff. But not a lot of new artists that are creating new funk or new R&B in the traditional sense. So I just wanted to bring it up to date and have a good time.
Well, let's play a song from Dookie Treats, if we could. The opening track is Everyday Hero.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Fungi's eye, not funk, fungi.
Fungi.
Hey, get some on! While away. Hit me!
I'm a legal
person. You got my phone, you're from fungus. Not funk.
Now, you're trying to set the table here?
Yeah, well, I want everybody to know that this record is about fun. You know, of course, there's a balance on the record. There's serious subjects tapped, but at the same time, there's a lot of fun and extemporaneous laughter going on in this record, and I wanted that reflected in the album.
Everyday hero.
wanted to touch on a subject which I think, you know, everyday people, you know, they're the heroes. They're the real heroes, not the ones you hear about every day in the news on NPR.
I want to ask you about a few more cuts, if we could. Sudan, and are you ready?
Yeah. Well, Sudan is a tragic situation. I believe artists have a tremendous responsibility to talk about, to sing about, to speak about, to write about the problems that are going on in this world. There's more going on in this world than bling bling, booty calls. There's more to write about than just love songs. And so I decided to approach this as a human tragedy, not a political situation, and talk about it. And I enlisted the help of Jonathan Butler and Tina Marie to help me sing this song. So it's an important and one of the more serious songs on the album. I got something to tell you, Sudan. It's a crying shame. Sudan, it's a crying shame.
While the UN bonds, words in the way. Rape and death are common, malnutrition and sorrow and torture every day. It's the shame of the world, the rape of baby girls, years of war and toil. Is it through wonder again, blacks killing blacks, who wins?
Artists, whether classical musicians or pop musicians, have always been the reflection of society and in many ways a healing part of whatever is wrong in society. And I think it's important for us to continue to do that, and I don't see enough of it today.
I think you might be the only person I can think of, without pressing myself too much, who in one lifetime has worked with both Frank Zappa, Miles Davis, and Cannonball Adderley.
Yes, Scott, that's pretty unique, actually, I must admit. But, you know, even in my production career, I've worked with everyone, like you say, from Miles Davis to Barry Manilow, and sometimes on the same day. So I'm the same guy, but
oh,
I wear
God.
Different hats.
I've got to ask. I mean, did you get him confused at one point?
You couldn't confuse Miles Davis and Barry Manilow. But they were both great guys. I mean, great. Yeah. I learned a lot working with Barry.
Could you pick from this album... a cut where you think somebody's influence is really apparent, even if just in a personal way to you, and share it with us?
Well, you know, you were talking about the song Are You Ready? That's a big influence. Earth, Wind & Fire was really, and I know all the guys, they're great guys, they were really influential on me in terms of my quote-unquote commercial career, because I thought they found the perfect ingredients to make great music, great lyrics, and still be popular. So Are You Ready is a pretty good tribute to Earth, Wind & Fire, I think.
You write so much music and produce so much music and are involved in so much music and play so much music. Do you ever just listen?
Oh, absolutely. In my iPod, I tell you, it's pretty diverse. Everything from Stravinsky to Sly and the Family Stone. So I do a lot of listening, yeah.
Any new artists you want to tip to us?
You know who I'm really liking right now is a young artist named Lettucey, who's a great singer, and she has yet to be fully tapped in terms of what her talent is all about. She's a great jazz singer. She's a great R&B singer, and I expect great things from her in the future.
You've done literally countless albums.
Mm-hmm.
What's over the horizon? What interests you?
One thing that I want to do is a big band record. That's something that I have not done, and I've done, you know, little bits and pieces of it on other people's records and things like that, but I've never actually done a George Duke big band record. So that's on the horizon. And also, I'd like to do a real strong fusion record. And then there are other things that, you know, more ethnically oriented projects where I take my experience and take them to, say, Africa or India and deal with musicians who aren't necessarily the popular musicians of the day, but people in the hills who may not even know what a half note or a quarter note are, they don't know what they are. Yeah. They just make music because they have to.
George, been delightful to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
George Duke, his new release, Dookie Treats. He joined us from NPR West, and you can hear more of George Duke's music and find out more about George Duke's music and perhaps the meaning of life if you come to our music website, npr.org/music.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.